Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Bananas today. Big blue skulls, hot big bugles, deep blue blood, let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the Teresa Brewer episode, which aired on November 21st, 1977, 45 years ago today. Pete, this episode is listed on the Wikia and on the DVDs as production episode 22.
Mm-hmm.
However, that doesn't make sense when you start digging into the dates.
Yep.
This was recorded and produced between July 12th and 14th, which is in the first half of episodes before they go on break. Bernadette Peters, as we mentioned previously, was the last episode before they went on break. She was recorded on August 16th, and then they returned with Rudolf Nureyev on August 18th. So this is before the break, and yet it's production episode 22 in the listings?
Yep, I was very confused by that when we announced it last week.
So this was filmed in between Edgar Bergen and Steve Martin.
Okay.
And production episode 21 is Bob Hope. That was filmed the day after this aired. So after the production break.
Mm-hmm.
The production episode after this is John Cleese. That was filmed at the exact same time as Dom DeLuise.
Interesting.
Has the exact same filming dates. So I checked the fandom page to see if there were any production notes as to why this is listed as production number 22, but has filming zero information.
Yeah, this is one of the barest notes or like extra details that I usually mine for fodder. And there's almost nothing on this fandom page.
There is a link at the bottom of the fandom page that links to Jim Henson's diary, which is run through Henson.com, and talks about and confirms the filming date. So at least we have solid records that it was filmed in the first half and therefore could be done in order to be aired at this early in the season. Except then why is it listed as production episode number 22?
I have no idea, because as we're about to talk about, everything in this episode, with the exception of like two things, is deeply tied to the theme of this episode.
But also, the fact that it was filmed in between the Bergen and the Martin episodes makes a certain amount of sense, because it feels like it has a similar deconstruction vibe to stuff that was going on in the Steve Martin episode. There are a lot of sketches in this that are abandoned or poked fun at the premise as they're doing it. They're messing around with form and format in this, which before I looked into the dates made me think, oh, of course this is a late production episode. They're burning off wild ideas. They feel free towards the end of the season to do stuff. So the fact that it is technically not production episode 22 because of when it was produced and aired makes me go, oh no, all of those conclusions are just me reading into it.
I have no idea what's going on. Right before we started, I said, oh yeah, I have a couple of questions for you that you won't have the answer to. Hey Ben, this was it. It was, how is this production episode 22?
Well, I'll just reiterate that this feels clever and interesting and deconstructive in a way that feels like people doing fun things with it. And I can only wonder if maybe what we have on the DVDs and on Disney Plus maybe is a re-edit. Maybe there was some post-airing stuff that happened to it that technically made it locked in production later, that it may have aired in an unfinished version. But the version that we have now is different.
Oh, I see what you're getting at. Who knows? I don't actually know how television production works.
Considering that, as I mentioned, production episode 23 will be the episode we do the episode after this. So two episodes from now. So there's a chance that some of this confusion will be cleared up as we dig into the John Cleese episode. So we'll be able to come back to this if in the next 2 weeks we're able to come up with any useful information.
Or if we never mention again, we found nothing. Yeah, it's a wild episode.
But as you say, it's an episode that is pretty integrated in terms of the guest star and the runner.
Yeah, and even the things that don't have to, like, normally we break out the things that don't have anything to do with either of those pieces and talk about them. Even, like, there's an at the dance in this episode that doesn't have to do with either the guest or directly to the runner, but the jokes are all thematically linked to the rest of the episode. So I think it's best if we just go top to bottom, running through everything, whether it has anything to do with the theme or not.
All right. Then in order to get started, and in order for me to talk about what happens in the dressing room before the title credits, as I always do, then...
Winky.
Then first, we need to find out a little bit about the episode's special guest star.
Yes. So, Ben, I've prepared 5 questions for you about Teresa Brewer. Question 1. Music, Music, Music was the song that helped break Teresa's career that we see in this episode, and we will talk about soon. It was the B-side on a 7-inch record that was way more successful than the A-side. However, Music, Music, Music was not the only song that had the same word repeated 3 times that Teresa Brewer sang.
Was the other Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice?
Ben? Didn't show up. Okay, we're good. Which of the following songs is not listed as being a song that Teresa Brewer sang? A. Baby, Baby, Baby. B. Boys, Boys, Boys. Or C. Sing, Sing, Sing.
2 of those are real.
2 of those were sung by Teresa Brewer along with Music, Music, Music.
Baby, Baby, Baby.
Incorrect. It was Boys, 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 which is a song recorded and sung by Lady Gaga. She did also sing a song in 1959 called Bye, 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 Baby, Goodbye. But that didn't fit the exact pattern.
Nope, nope.
But just like it made you laugh, it made me laugh. So she did sing a song called Baby, 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 which was featured...
She says baby too?
She does. A lot. 3 times. So, yes, she you threw me off. Don't remember what I was saying.
I understand that if you say baby, baby, baby 3 times, it conjures Ally McBeal's CGI baby to dance in front
of. Ooga, chaka, ooga, 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 chaka. So, speaking of baby, 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 that was a song that she sang in her only movie role in what 1953 musical? A. Cruisin' Down the River. B. Give a Girl a Break. Or C, Those Redheads from Seattle.
B.
Incorrect. It was Those Redheads from Seattle, which was the first 3D musical ever released in theaters.
Mm.
Kiss Me Kate is often attributed as being the first 3D musical, but Those Redheads from Seattle was released 1 month prior. Question 3. Which very famous singer's first public singing experience in the 12th grade was performing a song of Brewer's, Till I Waltz Again With You? A. Dolly Parton. B. Elvis Presley. Or C. Willie Nelson.
A.
Incorrect. It was sung by Elvis Presley in his 12th grade talent show. Till I Waltz Again With You was released in 1952 and was number 1 on the 1953 Billboard bestseller chart for 7 weeks and on the chart itself for 22 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. For a woman I've never heard of before, she was incredibly famous. Elvis Presley said that performance did much for his reputation. Quote, I wasn't popular in school, I failed music. Only thing I ever failed. And then they entered me in this talent show. When I came on stage, I heard people kind of rumbling and whispering and so forth because nobody knew I even sang. It was amazing how popular I became after that. So if it wasn't for Teresa Brewer, Elvis Presley may not have been Elvis Presley.
Wow.
Question number 4. In 1956, she co-wrote and recorded a song called I Love Mickey. Who was the titular Mickey who also appeared on the record? A. Mickey Gilley, a country singer. B. Mickey Mantle, the New York Yankees center fielder. Or C. Mickey Mouse, a famous animated mouse.
C.
Incorrect. Mickey Mantle. Now, are you ready for some dubious follow-up information about that song? According to a sentence in Teresa's Wikipedia that does not even have a citation needed notation,
But it, does it have a source citation?
No, it is just a sentence with sentences around it that are not cited either. It was reported that Teresa and Mickey Mantle developed a mutual attraction. However, I believe in 1956, Teresa was happily married. Which leads me to question five. Pretty much everything I've talked about has taken place in the 50s and 60s because that's when she was most famous. Her career dwindled because she regularly turned down offers that would cause her to be away from her children. But in 1972, she divorced her first husband, and shortly thereafter, she remarried, who she credits both him, her second husband, and her daughters for expanding her musical horizons, which likely led her away from being the novelty act she was often considered to be, which helped give her career a resurgence in the mid-70s. Why she's on the Muppet Show that we watched. So, who was Teresa Brewer's second husband? A. Bob Thiel, producer of the song What a Wonderful World. B. Brian Eno, old sourpuss himself. Or C. Giorgio Moroder, widely regarded as the person responsible for disco.
I'm cheating because I looked up music, 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 and so I know that the 70s remix was done because of Bob Thiel.
Fair. I'll give it to you. I was kind of hoping you kind of saw that because there was also a disco remix of Music, 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 which is why I threw in Giorgio Moroder. So yeah, she didn't act in a lot of things. She had lots of like guest appearances. She was actually the very first guest on The Tonight Show after Jack Parr left. There was a period of time before it went to Johnny Carson, and she was on the first Jack Parless episode.
Huh.
She guested on lots of things. She was herself in a lot of things. She did a little bit of television acting. But like I said, people really liked her performance in Those Redheads in from Seattle. But when they offered her a three-picture deal, it would have meant she would have had to be away from home for a long time. And she was unwilling to do it.
So Music, 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 which is the closing number of the show, was first written in 1949, but was recorded in 1950 with Teresa Brewer as the main voice of a band that was called the Dixieland All-Stars. How old was she in 1950?
May 7th, 1931 was her birthday.
So she would have been 19. So teenager is appropriate, but
yeah, she
just barely. I'm just thinking more along the lines of for her to be singing in 50, to have a well-established enough career that Elvis as 18 is singing her songs in 1954, and for her to then be doing a second act career resurgence in 1977 after having re-recorded the disco version at her husband's behest in 1976. We've talked a couple of times about where people are in their careers, and I love the idea of The Muppet Show as being part of a relaunch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great opportunity to, either as Steve Martin did, get some of your club material to be known by just about everybody. Or what it seems to be here, for her to have an opportunity to maybe slightly redefine herself as still current, as still able to play along and not just something from before rock and roll, which is literally what the first version of Music, Music, Music sounds like. The 1949 version is Oompa-esque. It has, I don't know the specific name of the tempo that it has, but it appears on a compilation of German beer hall songs. And I don't think it's just because of her last name. I think it's because it has that let's all sing together, and it's talking about Nickelodeons. It's talking about old school. We'll get to the sketch itself. They've updated it to be a jukebox, but that still feels...
That's still 50s.
Yes. Like, yeah, but it feels pre-rock and roll is my point. And so for her to now be established well and truly in post-rock and roll or rock and roll diversification of the 70s, if you've been thought of as a punchline or as something that's wildly dated by almost a generation at this point.
Yeah, see, my issue with this episode is that if she's trying to relaunch her career, why is she only doing all the stuff from her past? Like, Music, 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 I get why she's doing that, but it still sounds like a 50s song. The Dixieland song is a Dixieland song. Bob Thiel was a famous jazz producer.
Okay.
And she gets more into jazz performance after marrying him. That's the musical expansion that her daughters and him
moved her towards.
Yeah. And so if that's where she's going, why is she only looking backwards? Why isn't she saying, hey, everyone, yes, that's who I was then, but this is who I am now. She's not giving us any of the, this is who I am now.
Well, I think while she's an incredibly game performer and has some great backstage moments with the Muppets, I am very critical of her two musical pieces in this. So in order to talk about them, let's get into talking about the episode. Because I'm fascinated to deconstruct them, particularly because we've been focusing so much this season on good old Phil Kazon and his musical direction. These are bizarre in that perspective.
Yep.
So let's dig into them by starting with 13 seconds to curtain, Ms. Brewer, as Scooter says as he pops in the dressing room right at the fade-up.
He asks if she needs a hand. And then a giant blue hand comes in and nudges her.
I do enjoy the fact that giant blue hand has an entry on the Muppet Wiki.
Yeah, very good.
You're getting real granular there, Internet.
But it shows up multiple times, so I guess you need it.
And I suppose if you've constructed a giant blue hand that, you know, is effectively a hand costume that a person can walk around in like a giant Muppet, you might as well use it as frequently as possible. Mm-hmm.
She then hits Scooter.
Yes.
She gives him a gentle little hit, but I'm still counting it as the first hit of the episode. Cuts to curtain.
Well, hang on.
Yeah.
What about the hand coming down on Teresa Brewer?
It nudges her. It does not hit her.
Well, we'll get back to that when we get back to the reappearance of the hand.
Yes.
Okay.
It does not hit her. She hits him.
Got it.
For curtain watch, it cuts to curtain at 17 seconds. So he said 13 seconds, 2 seconds in. Close. Not enough.
Kermit then does a very bizarre Miss Teresa Brewer, where everything gets an exclamation mark. We don't often comment on how Kermit says the name, because usually there isn't much to say, but I thought this one was surprisingly weird.
Yep, I agree.
It's the Muppet Show with our special guest star, Miss Teresa Brewer!
Definitely made me notice it, too.
Statler and Waldorf are in the box, but so is a blue Frackle, who happens to be sitting in Statler's seat.
And so Statler asks to see his ticket stub. Pretty good joke. I liked that.
And then, while Gonzo gets up in the O for the final bit, as he blows into the trumpet, it effectively is a flamethrower. And a massive jet of fire and sound comes out. And then he says,
Sorry.
I like that too. And again, creative. We haven't seen fire before.
We've seen smoke. Pete, where there's smoke, there's fire.
It's true. It's very, very true.
So we've had three different colors of smoke. Will you be irritated if we have three different colors of fire?
No, because fire's cool. I mean, it's hot, but it's cool. Kermit then introduces Teresa, and it's so rare for the guest star to be the first act.
Right.
So I was shocked when I watched this to be like, oh, already? Okay.
We go straight into the opening number, which is Cotton Fields. It's produced on a mock-up of a paddle wheel steamboat, where the Electric Mayhem, sans Dr. Teeth, is playing next to Teresa. And in the cabin of the boat, Fozzie is driving and or leaning out of the window to gawk at Teresa and to ring a bell.
Acting like Steamboat Willie. In the Steamboat Willie position.
Yeah, I get it. I can see it. Cotton Fields is written by Leadbelly and was originally written in 1947, but wasn't released by him and a recording formally until 1953. It was recorded by Harry Belafonte and by Odetta in 58 and 59. There's a performance on the Newport Folk Festival compilation album of Odetta's performance of it that's quite good. And then in the 60s, it suddenly becomes a white person song, where you have the Highwaymen, the Seekers, and Johnny Cash all performing it. And then in 69, both the Beach Boys and Creedence Clearwater Revival do versions of this.
Wild.
Teresa Brewer herself recorded it in 1972, prior to doing it on The Muppet Show. And I have to say, despite a 25-year history of white men performing this song and lots of others, I still found myself listening to these lyrics and saying, I don't like this being performed by white people. It bugged me.
Yeah. A couple weeks ago, I made a comment about, I'm not a country boy, but I tend to really like the country music.
The Muppet Show does.
Muppet Show stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben?
Yeah.
I'm a liar. I hated this. I hated this for so many reasons.
To talk about a couple of them.
It's boring. Visually, and it's too long.
I knew you were going to talk about the length, but talk about the length. How long is this song?
2.95 minutes.
Okay.
So just under three.
I wouldn't have been surprised if this was the full length song, because they did two verses, a bridge, and then a reprise. And when they came back...
And an instrumental break.
Yeah. Yeah. When they came back around, I was kind of shocked that they were doing the second yodel and the reprise of the chorus slash first verse. I was like, how is this song not over yet?
Mm-hmm. And visually, it's a three-camera shot.
Yeah.
There's a shot of the whole thing straight on. There's a camera turned 30 degrees to the left and a camera turned 30 degrees to the right. And that's it.
The stage itself, the set construction of the boat, is very flat, very square, very high school drama.
Yeah.
And it doesn't allow for very much interesting stuff to do. The Electric Mayhem are kind of wasted in this.
Mm-hmm.
And Fozzie's contribution of getting excited and ringing the bell...
is the only, quote, saving grace, and there's nothing to it.
But also, it's not especially funny.
No. Another thing that we talked about in a past episode, Teresa claps during this.
Yes.
But it's soundless, unlike the Bernadette Peters clapping.
I've spent a little bit thinking about our classic dubbing issue. Here's my guess. I think this was studio pre-recorded, and I think Teresa is an absolute pro at being able to mouth along with her own lyrics.
She is known for her yodeling ability.
Mm.
So, yeah, I absolutely buy that. That she's done this 100 times. She knows the song, and she just matches it perfectly.
Well, I think some people fall into the trap of not fully singing and projecting while they're singing along with a pre-recorded track. And so you can tell by the fine play of the muscles in the neck and the chest that they're not creating the same amount of effort in order to pitch control.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell that her body was producing sound. And so I did think she's probably singing even if they're not using the live sound.
Yep. But after a compliment, let's tear her back down. In pretty much all of the acts, she just stands there.
Yeah.
She is motionless, essentially.
And so this is my first question before we get to music, 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 where we'll raise the same concern, is whose failure of imagination is this? When they came to her and said, we'd like you to do this stuff, we want to integrate you in the episode, what are good things for us to do, what are songs that you want to perform? Who came up with the concept of, we're doing a song about enslaved people picking cotton? You're a white lady with dyed blonde hair. What do we want to create as an atmosphere for that? And we go with a Mississippi paddle boat. So it's set firmly in the South, but it's not directly acknowledging the privilege of the lyrics.
But yeah, it's rough.
It's flat, it's long, it's boring, and it's problematic.
And we've done two of those things in covering it.
Then let's move on.
Yep. So, speaking of problematic, let's move to the backstage runner.
Oh, yeah. The one piece...
Buckle in, listeners, if you didn't watch this episode. It's not going to get better.
The one piece of research I didn't do... Well, the one piece of research that occurs to me as we bring up this topic that I didn't do is how much this is of a piece with culture in 77. Where was the rise of aerobic fitness? Because the runner is...
Piggy needs to lose weight. Not her choice to lose weight. She overhears Kermit and Scooter talking about she has a ballet number on the schedule for next week's show, and Kermit has decided to cut it because he thinks Piggy is, quote, getting a little bulgy. And then they go on to make a number of other body-shaming jokes about... And jokes was also in quotes there, if you couldn't hear me, about Piggy.
Let's point out, They're not funny. No. They're clearly structured as jokes. And both Scooter and Kermit are giggling up a storm at their witticisms as they come up with clever ways to say that Piggy is fat.
You know, the fork no longer fits in the barrel.
Yeah, her wiggles are beginning to waddle a little.
Yeah, that's the way the old pork rolls.
Piggy comes out of her dressing room while it's happening, overhears it, pretends that she didn't hear it, and she decides to take control of the situation by volunteering to go on a diet, which then Kermit shames her into upping her weight loss goal until he seems like he's pleased with her decision.
Yeah, she starts off by saying she's going to lose 5 and lets it hang in the air, and Kermit sort of goes, as if that isn't good enough, and then it turns into a mock auction routine where they go up with increments of 5.
I have a feeling that in 77, diet culture was on the rise because we'll talk later. Teresa talks about how she's sick of everyone talking about dieting soon.
But also, I think the sketch of Piggy in the prop room doing exercise is genuinely funny and feels like a good satire on weight loss culture.
Yeah. I'll say this again when we get there. Yeah. But if that segment was divorced from the rest of this runner and in an entirely different episode and just Piggy was working out in the back room, I'd love it. But I can't separate it out from this episode because of the rest.
Yeah. That should have been the heart of the plot. Because that sketch and the sketch with the scale are both funny and have some good positive moments in it. But because it starts with two men talking about a woman getting too fat to be on stage and then shaming her into losing more weight than she wants to is gross.
Yeah. Bad job, Muppets. We'll say that again many more times throughout this episode, I'm sure. We're not usually this harsh on you, but you deserve it this time. But after that bad backstage segment, we get a Pigs in Space, except it also is rude to Piggy.
Starts off with the vocab words indomitable, flappable, and inexplicable, which I'm 90% sure are words we've already used this season.
The plot of this one is that the Swine Trek is running low on critical resources, which the crew is okay with that happening, but then they find out that they're almost out of swill, and Hog Throb and Strange Pork lose it, and they ask Piggy to make some more.
We learn crucial information to answer our earlier questions about how big the Swine Trek is and how many other pigs are running around on it, because we get told that there are 25 adult pigs on this ship and that they all need to survive. Now, I'm assuming that includes the 3 that we have on the bridge. Mm. And so therefore we have a random collection of engineering, security, and other Star Trek pigs spread throughout other departments. Mostly they seem to show up at the door and bring something in. And yeah, we had one pig do that today to bring in the message about no swill.
That's right. Piggy thankfully stands up for herself and refuses to continue with the sketch.
But also starts by saying, I'm the first mate, I'm supposed to give orders. Which I liked, that she's been the butt of the jokes. And I generally like the tension of the setup that Link is an idiot. Mm-hmm. And Strange Pork is a buffoon. And Piggy is strong and violent. That's a good dynamic of two idiot men who think that they're in charge and Piggy has to set them straight either by violence or by cunning. I'm generally okay with that as a setup for things.
Yep.
But in this case,
it comes across as, hey woman, please make us food.
Particularly since the previous 2 sketches ago that we did it was, as we mentioned, the ironing board one, where the joke that they keep on seeming to go back to is, hey, lady in Star Trek, you should be doing domestic duties.
Yeah.
If Mad TV did more than one sketch where everyone on the Enterprise was just like, Uhura, we need you to do the laundry. If they did it more than once, we would be like, you need to do better than that.
Yeah. At least the ironing one, they had the creativity to rename the thing so it was a misdirect of what they were talking about. In this one, it was simply make more swill.
But as you say, the turn on this sketch is that Piggy, as Piggy, stops being first mate Miss Piggy and then just says, you know what, I'm done.
I refuse to continue this sketch, you hear me?
Sketch? What sketch? This is the swine truck. We're lost in endless space.
This is a cheap shot comedy sketch and I lay your odds the frog wrote it.
And Hogthrob and Strange Pork are valiantly refusing to acknowledge that they're in a sketch or that Piggy is breaking character and try to keep the sketch going while she's basically like, I don't have time for this nonsense anymore. And we see Link and Julius do backup songs and various other things out of costume. So we know that they are actors in the show. It's not like Piggy shows up and Piggy's playing a character, but they're deluded fools who think that they're always on the swine track. They are also actors in the show, but they played it 100% like they didn't know that they were in a sketch. So much so that when Scooter pops up to say,
Kermit says, get on with the sketch, okay?
Red alert! Emergency!
The hideous space creature has spotted a ship!
They set off alarms on the bridge and start to attack him because they think that he's an alien that's popped up. And they don't deliver those lines like, we're staying in character and we're yes-anding this bit.
Yeah, they truly believe that he's a hideous space creature.
And Scooter looks scared because they're attacking him. He's confused that they're not breaking character.
Yeah. Yeah, as bad as this sketch is, the end of it's pretty good.
End of it's great.
Yeah.
Even so much that there's a shot of Piggy just sort of looking at them, continuing to be in character and abusing Scooter, and she just walks off set. No comment, no line, just is done with this nonsense.
It's a pre-office take to camera.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Even though Muppets don't have exact facial features, you can tell.
Well, all of the puppeteers are very good at knowing their camera angles. Mm-hmm. It helps, of course, that they have their monitors that they can work to. But they know how to tilt the heads in order to create expressions without physically changing the puppet.
Yeah, and it communicates everything in that moment. After Pigs in Space, we have Animal playing Wild Thing on his drums.
One of the few moments in this episode that are disconnected from either of the two basic runners of guest star and or Piggy being fed up with feeding.
But there is a connection in this, which is Janice and the pig that take Animal away.
Mm-hmm.
They're wearing their veterinarian's hospital gowns. There's no veterinarian's hospital in this episode.
But Piggy will later wear a vet's hospital outfit as if she's preparing to go do one.
Yep, and we never see it. So Ben, I think we have our first case of not seeing something that the paying audience in the theater saw.
We have had another bit of Piggy dressed up in a Pigs in Space outfit.
That's right.
And then we didn't have a Pigs in Space in that. And at the time, we dismissed that as a continuity error.
But in this one, we have two veterinarians' hospitals.
So I wrote down in my notes that Janice is wearing her Nurse Janice outfit. But I didn't link it to Piggy being in her Nurse Piggy outfit later. You're basically constructing a
C-plot.
A headcanon of the idea that there was a vet's hospital and Animal was the patient.
Yeah.
And so, Pete, in Animal Watch, if Animal is the patient and Animal's a monster and not an animal, is the patient an animal?
Yes, because it's Animal. So the patient is not an animal. It is Animal.
But the question is always, is the patient an animal?
No, the doctor was the mother.
But yes, the sketch ends with a pig and Janice putting butterfly nets on him in the classic escape from a lunatic asylum bit, which is a little bizarre considering that Animal's performance of Wild Thing, made famous by the Trogs in 1966, so much so that when Jimi Hendrix performed it at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, going so far as to set his guitar on fire at the end of it. There's nothing particularly wild or crazy or aggressive about it, especially compared to Jimmy.
Well, he hits his floor tom so hard that it falls out the bottom.
Mm.
But yeah, that's supposed to be the bit. And at the end of the song, the track is going really wild, and Animal is almost still as they get ready to put the butterfly nets on over him. And it's really disconnected between the music. I often harp on this.
Yes.
But especially in this moment, it's wild to be like, oh no, that drum track is going crazy, and he is barely moving.
I wondered how annoyed you'd be at that because, A, as you point out, lack of coordination between the puppeteering and the music track does irritate you, but B, you have been in favor of Animal that I wondered if you would give him a pass and give Frank a pass for not quite being as facile because I think he's doing more.
Yeah, it's very
on the drums than we normally get because we've got foot pedals and we've got the hi-hat.
Hi-hat was great.
So it's more complicated than it usually is than just Frank sort of head bopping and doing two arms.
With drums, I'm not so keyed up about it, especially because, like I said, that hi-hat was great. So that is a saving grace for me. But I don't like how it tapers off before it should taper off. Otherwise, yeah, this was fine. Also, it was only... Oh, no, it was almost a minute and a half.
This is the rough equivalent of a Rolf sketch.
Yeah. And also, Animal sings along to it. It's not just drums.
Yep.
He does sing the lyrics and put the song in the first person, which is fun.
For whatever reason, they don't sing groovy. And I wondered if that was a network note. If somebody thought that maybe that particular lyric was dicey.
Based off of the rest of this episode, I think they didn't need to worry about it. Statler and Waldorf then have their first appearance of the episode besides the credits, and they wonder where he took them.
And Statler says, well, wherever it is, I bet it's more fun than here.
And for once, I 100% agree with that.
Back in front of the curtain, Kermit does a variation on Gonzo Patter that we'll hear a couple of times in a major feat of death-defying fill-in-the-blank never before seen. The great Gonzo will fill-in-the-blank. That's the structure of Gonzo intros. And in this case, the blanks are intellectualism and will recite Shakespeare hanging from his nose from a feather boa.
I didn't know that this was... boilerplate. Based off of the description in this one, I made the comment of it seems like something Sam should be introducing, not Kermit. Because death-defying intellectualism
is a great phrase.
Yeah, and sounds like something that Sam would be all about. And then for it to be Shakespeare, boy oh boy, he would be loving this.
No, I get back to Sam being critical of Yes, We Have No Bananas. That is a song that he should like. But because it's being done in a way that's weird, he hates it. So he would not enjoy death-defying intellectualism. He wants things to be intellectual, but in a nice conservative way.
Fair.
And so I think Shakespeare with a feather boa is already too freaky-deaky for Sam.
But the curtain is parted, and it is revealed that Gonzo is, as described, hanging by his nose from a feather boa wearing a stunt costume.
Yeah, he's wearing basically a glittery jumpsuit like he's about to be shot out of a cannonball.
Yeah, with a cape on it. It's a good look. And it's full-bodied Muppet, which always is a way to get me on board.
As he begins with Merchant of Venice, Act 1, Scene 1, in the first couple of lines, the feathers tickle his nose, he sneezes and knocks himself off the boa and falls crashing to the ground.
The very dangerous 9 feet
down. Yeah, but that's probably 3 times his height.
Yeah. It still is a... I didn't do the math on this one I did a couple weeks ago. The whistle and crash seems like it's longer than 9 feet would take to fall. And the crash is much louder than a 9-foot crash would be.
I'm just saying, if I fell 3 times my height, it would suck.
Yeah, but...
But you're saying that your chance to achieve close to terminal velocity is considerably less in Gonzo's case.
Yes. The next segment is a backstage segment with both the runner and our special guest.
That's right. This is the nexus point of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Where Piggy lets herself into Miss Brewer's dressing room. She's seated at a table that has some plates of cookies and stuff in front of her that go unremarked upon for most of the first half of this sketch. And Piggy is addressing her concerns at the comments that she overheard, but saying that she's asking for a friend who has a teensy-weensy weight problem and wants to know if Teresa might have some advice for this hypothetical companion.
Being a very small person herself.
That's right.
Teresa then comments like, well, why don't we talk about this while we eat lunch? Because I've got this smorgasbord in front of me.
And Piggy is at first resistant and makes that sort of classic Frank grunting, squealing noise of trying to resist something. It's not dissimilar to the noise he makes when Piggy's like pulling on iron bars or straining muscularly, but it's a good noise nevertheless. But then she falls through temptation and says that she will join Teresa for lunch.
Yeah, because Teresa puts down a big pink milkshake on the table and then a big frosted cake. Those are the things that break Piggy's willpower.
That's true. So Teresa says, yes, I'm so glad that to talk to somebody who's not on a diet. I'm so sick of hearing about calorie counts and it's such a bore.
So cool. More body shaming. Not directly body shaming, but also saying like, oh, people who are on diets are bad.
Well, I mean, yes, obviously. But now I'm going to take both sides of this argument and say, I agree that people who are going through something that requires repetition and concentration tend to then get lost in the minutiae of the program that they're doing in order to feel better. And while the effects can be useful, they can be health-based, there can be all sorts of good reasons to get fit and take care of yourself, the kind of thing that it does to conversation with people who are going through that stuff is obnoxious. People who can just talk about, I ran another quarter mile or I got my speed up a little bit. And it's, you know, it's a perfectly normal thing of like, I'm concentrating on increasing my numbers. I'm focusing a lot of emotional energy on this. And therefore, I then need to process it with other people. God, it's boring.
Yeah, but you wouldn't normally say that to the person directly.
I think you and I know that's not true.
Yeah, I know. Well, Ben, I was trying to lie to our audience on your behalf.
At this juncture, Kermit lets himself into the dressing room in order to tell Teresa that she's done such a great job, that her opening number was beautiful, and then he sees that Piggy's there.
I made that noise too. Her opening number was beautiful.
Kermit, as one of the worst producers ever, is still doing his job of making his guest star feel good.
Ben, we just talked about saying the truth in front of people.
And Kermit said the truth in front of Piggy earlier, and it was not a good idea.
He didn't know he was saying the truth in front of Piggy, though.
Yeah.
But yes, he sees Piggy in front of all this food and says something to the effect of, oh, you're not eating this, are you? And then says,
You weren't thinking of doing anything with that cake there, were you, fat stuff?
Until now.
And Piggy reacts by smashing his face into that delicious-looking cake.
When the cake came out, I was like, that is a fluffy, tall cake. That's a mound. And I was trying to think, like, is it solid? Is it a meringue? And then it became clear that what it was a giant pile to have somebody's head squished into it.
Yeah, it didn't actually look delicious. But, yeah.
Depends on how much you like whipped cream.
Yeah. Piggy also storms out of the dressing room and slams the door. When she slams the door, she says hi-ya.
It's true.
Which is the first non-hit hi-ya, I believe. Because she didn't hit the door.
No. She did a karate chop motion with her hand on the doorknob.
Yep.
Yeah, I went back and watched that to be like, what is going on there? Is she supposed to be chopping at the door and it closes? No, she just
slams the door shut saying hi-ya.
Just venting her anger in the traditional Piggy way. And the sketch ends with Teresa saying, how about that frosted frog? I didn't really like Teresa's button, but I don't blame her. I think she tried to do something with the material, and I think it was a lame line.
Mm-hmm. We then have an at the dance.
It's true. So my notes, wherever I read it, that said that there were no more at the dances after the first season, have been now definitely wrong, because we've had two satirical At the Dances, but now we have a genuine At the Dance.
Yep. But Ben, it's not a genuine At the Dance. You know why?
Why? Because there's no George.
There's Mildred. No Pogo George.
And so that's the criteria.
This is a fake At the Dance.
So you're going to maintain that my earlier erroneous comment is true until George comes back. And since it's basically been established that we aren't going to see George in a vocal role again.
Hey, you know what?
Yeah.
Piggy was in this At the Dance sketch. She wasn't vocal.
That's true.
So it could have been George.
It's true. We could have had George dancing, even if George didn't participate in the jokes. But yeah, we have four jokes about dieting and food. And each of the four couples dancing delivers one. And then there's a fifth couple dancing, which is Piggy and a nameless pig. And it was a little interesting that everybody else was doing food jokes while the person who's having a food crisis on the show is dancing in amongst them.
Mm-hmm. It was fine.
The fourth joke is...
And then she had the nerve to tell me that I was overweight. Can you believe that? Overweight? Isn't that the most absurd thing you ever heard?
Ah! And then there's the creaking sound of the floorboards underneath them, and they are so heavy that they create a hole in the dance floor, and then each of the other dancing couples, one at a time, dances towards and falls into the hole, terminating with Piggy and her partner.
Yep.
Here's a funny note for you.
Yeah.
In DVD subtitles are terrible, watch.
Ooh.
When the floor creaks and they fall into the hole, the subtitles say, fabric tearing. And so I was anticipating this was going to be I'm wearing a girdle and my body explodes out of my clothes. Because yep. I saw the subtitle before the sound effect happened and I was like, oh, good grief. We're doing a I'm so fat, I'm busting out of my clothes. But no, they just got it wrong. So six of one, half dozen of the other.
Speaking of watches, in content warning watch, there's no content warning on this episode because apparently Disney doesn't care about fat shaming.
And as you say, this is an episode that has almost minimal content on the fandom page, which means Nickelodeon also had no problem with any of the bullying and teasing that was going on in this episode to be aimed at the kiddies.
Hey, in the mid-90s, I get it. In 2022, Disney?
You could do better, Disney.
Yeah. If you're going to put a content warning in front of the rightfully problematic Steve Martin episode, maybe just do the same thing of like, hey, these were jokes then. Maybe
these jokes were wrong then and they are wrong now.
Yeah.
And we're presenting this episode uncut as a historical record.
But as is traditional with an At the Dance, it fades to black and we come back with the UK spot.
The UK spot is, and we use this word a lot, wild.
Here's a little number now that we dedicate to my favorite food, and we call it cheesecake.
A song by Louis Armstrong and
really?
The songwriter Irving Fields called Cheesecake. And the lyrics are cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake.
And second verse, cheesecake, munching on a cheesecake, munching on a cheesecake.
Yeah, actually, those are in the opposite order. But either way.
Amazing.
I was legitimately confused that this was a real song until it kept going.
Oh, my girl, she's crazy over cheesecake all the time. So I bring her cheesecake and she treats me mighty fine.
Which is why my reaction in real time of you telling me that this is by Louis Armstrong. Wild.
There is an autobiography by Irving Fields, and he has a couple pages talking about the writing of this song.
Awesome.
Where he says he was at a deli and he had cheesecake for breakfast.
Yeah, this is totally a song that you sing to yourself while you're eating cheesecake and going, like, and then just doing a happy dance in thinking about the cheesecake you're about to eat or while you're eating cheesecake. Because I famously do a pizza dance if I'm standing while eating a slice of pizza. I will do a little shimmy.
No, he finished his cheesecake. He then got on his bicycle and was riding through the streets. And the sound of his tires on the cobblestones made a bump-a-da-bump-a-da-bump-a-da song. And he was doing the rhythm, going, and it's like, I need some lyrics for this, and then retroactively did his Happy Cheesecake lyrics to the rhythm of his Tires on Rocks.
Hey, I complain a lot about Dr. Teeth songs. I have no complaints about this one.
I have a minor complaint about this one.
You better not, because it's great.
Pete.
Yeah.
Dr. Teeth.
Yeah.
Celebrated pianist.
Mm-hmm.
Has a wonderful piano solo in the middle of this song.
Uh-huh.
During the rest of the instrumentation of this song, you can't hear the piano. So he's jamming along, and you can hear the drums and the horns and the guitar. But you can't hear the only instrument that's on stage.
Oh, cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake.
Cheesecake.
Ben, I don't see a problem with this. You know why? Cheesecake, gobble, gobble, cheesecake. I don't care about anything else. Lyrically, this song should win every Grammy. Ever, always.
The first verse is just Dr. Teeth singing these lyrics to his favorite food, which is sitting on top of the upright piano. The second verse, the cheesecake joins in and says, after the end of each line, cheesecake!
Excellent.
In a marvelous piece of ontology. And then, after the piano solo bridge, a group of monsters gather around the piano and all join in. And then upon the conclusion of the song, they all swarm the cheesecake as if to eat it, and it mysteriously is able to sneak out from next to the beautiful day monster. And the cheesecake says to camera, I'm getting out of here. At which point, Piggy walks on camera, sees the cheesecake leaving, and follows after it.
Again, if this was a different episode, I'd love that ending.
Mm.
In this episode, I don't like that ending. Because it's just reinforcing that she has food issues.
Mm.
And it's like, not now, Muppets. Do that in a different episode where that's not the topic.
So you have no problem with the fact that the cheesecake apparently can hover in midair because it comes down off the top of the piano and then is at about shoulder height, just at the lip of the camera, at which point it then moves. Its plate is clearly a flying saucer.
Yeah, I have no issues with this sketch. We just went over this. I don't care about the piano. It's a song about a cheesecake that I would make up by myself while I'm eating cheesecake. I love it. I love it. Okay, I just said all of that positive things. I do have a complaint. In another segment of 45 years to punch anything up, the last line should be the cheesecake saying, I gotta cheese it. As in, I gotta get out of here.
The way in which mobsters in cartoons will say, cheese it, it's the cops!
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it could be better. So, 99 out of 100 the sketch gets.
I don't know. Something about that joke just curdles in my stomach.
I've stopped the recording. And I'm leaving. I don't know how our listeners are hearing this right now, but we're no longer recording.
Yeah, well, it was either that joke or saying, I don't think that that's very good. I think it's kind of a cheesy punch-up.
Well, that's just rude to me.
Yeah, that's why I didn't go for that one.
Mm. I still don't know how our listeners are hearing this right now.
After the best UK spot so far, according to Pete, we have another dressing room segment where Kermit is impressed that Teresa has a autograph book with some wonderful signatures in it, including Bing Crosby, future second season guest Bob Hope, and the aforementioned Louis Armstrong, but also a page with a giant burned hole in the middle of it. When Kermit asks, well, whose signature is that? It turns out that it's Crazy Harry's.
Who then appears and asks if she wants another one, and they quickly dismiss him.
Kermit then says, oh, well, I didn't realize you were getting autographs from the Muppets. And she says, oh, yeah, I've got almost all of them. Which Kermit, because he didn't know she was getting Muppet autographs, realizes that she hadn't gotten his autograph. It is sort of teetering between jealousy and despair. But then she realizes, oh, wait, there's one that she hasn't gotten, perhaps the most important of them all.
Yeah, and Kermit kind of does a little shimmy. He's very pleased with himself. Note. This won't come as a surprise. I don't like Kermit in this episode. He's controlling over Piggy, and now he's very egotistical. Boo this man.
Well, he's about to get his comeuppance then, because as he's already been saying, like, oh, well, I'm so pleased, I don't know what to say, she says, well, just You don't need to know what to say. You just need to tell me how to get Animal's autograph.
I mean, good.
Animal also happens to be walking past the dressing room at that precise moment and says, autograph! And grabs Teresa.
Tackles her to the floor.
And she comes up with his name scrawled in grease pencil across her forehead. At which point she then says, I love it, while doing an Animal impression.
I love it!
Yeah, this is great.
She's very funny, and this sketch is very funny.
Yeah.
And Kermit is a big dope.
Uh-huh. Boo that man, frog. Boo that man, frog.
Boo that man, frog.
Ooh, Ben.
Yeah.
Can Boo that man, frog be our first t-shirt?
I'm pretty sure our first t-shirt is going to be wild speculation.
Fair. However, Boo that man, frog. I very much enjoy.
Let's get that hashtag trending, people. But speaking of things that you like, the next segment is Muppet Labs. And it starts off with just Bunsen. And I was worried that maybe we weren't going to see Beaker in this episode. But no, it's just a delayed reveal.
The invention this week is an electric nose warmer, which Bunsen doesn't really have much of a nose. So it would be very hard for him to be testing it out on himself.
As usual, the writing of his patter is brilliant. The line, I believe, is, how many times have you ever been out on a cold, nippy day and gotten your nose cold? Wouldn't it be nice if you could warm it electrically?
We have only to turn on the electricity. And there's Beaker with a nice, toasty, warm nose.
I initially thought that based off of the way Beaker's nose starts burning once and smoking once he puts it on, that they keep talking about being electrified, and at the very end, Beaker, while being electric...
While conducting electricity.
Yeah, sure. That's the... While Beaker's conducting electricity, he touches him, and then Bunsen also starts shaking with electricity. That it wouldn't smoke and...
cause him to shake and twitch?
Yeah, I think I missed the first time around that it was electric and not just a heating coil. Mm. On the second viewing, I realized that, no, it is purely electric.
So you thought that the smoke was that he was catching on fire as opposed to that he
due
was...
due to the heat.
That not... he was just transferring current.
Yes.
And that the natural resistance of flesh and or felt was what was causing him to smoke.
Yeah. So at the end, once he grabs him and they both start shaking, I was like, that wouldn't happen. On the second viewing, I got it.
When he calls Beaker on to be the test subject, Beaker is waving his hands in a silent plea, ducked down as low as possible at the lip of the desk, being like, I don't want to be here. No, 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 no.
It's so good.
We haven't really gotten Beaker in full meep mode yet. He's not really there. This is still proto-Beaker, and so he's mostly silent.
Yeah, especially in this one, but I think he meeped once or twice in the last one.
He was definitely making noises, but I don't think he's really codified that, much in the way in which we don't have Fozzie waka waka walking yet.
Even though he should.
The word meep isn't really a defined catchphrase and or sound that he's making. He's just making squeaky squeals. But that particular enunciation of the phoneme is yet to have been established.
Which is interesting, considering what we talked about in a past episode about how season one, that head writer who I can't remember his name of right now,
Jack Burns,
really wanted to establish catchphrases.
Yeah.
And the most famous catchphrases from the show are still yet to come.
It's true.
After they fired that man because they didn't agree with what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that happens with writing teams is that you start with broadly sketched character, and then you bring more and more individual particulars to them as you write them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get that feedback loop of performer and writer so that they start finding, oh, like, that was a really great thing that they did. Let's do that again because they delivered it really well. I don't think anybody set out to probably write these catchphrases that became established, but once they got written once, then they were like, that was good, let's do that again.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying.
I agree with it. It's a palpable irony that a man that basically tried to shortcut the process was let go because that was the wrong instinct. As opposed to letting it evolve organically and having it be character-based, he was like, no. We are going to fabricate clever ways to lock on to these people.
Ben?
Yeah?
That was a nice analysis. Nice analysis.
I thought you were going to do a, Ben, they're made of felt. Of course you have to fabricate.
Nope, I was doing...
You were doing a phrase callback.
Yeah.
Well done.
You're welcome. Speaking of callbacks, Statler and Waldorf are next.
Statler says that was great, but Waldorf is much less engaged and basically gives a Pete-esque meh.
Mm-hmm. And then calls him an old fool. Waldorf says, don't call him an old fool. He'll give you the evil eye. And
now, you must have seen where this was going when he said the phrase evil eye.
Oh, yeah. However, what I didn't see was the horror, the true body horror that was about to happen.
On the receiving end or on the giving end?
Both.
Oh, see, I assumed that because we've seen that what Waldorf can do is basically turn himself into a madball.
Yeah.
With having one distended, bulging eye. That when he said evil eye, I was like, here we go. We're getting mad, mutant, toxic Avenger Waldorf again.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we got. And I still don't like it. It's still body horror.
But what happens is that while it may look like he's the Toxic Avenger, what Waldorf is apparently actually channeling is Sadako, because...
I have the same note. I have the same note.
He freezes Statler in a 100% somebody just crawled out of the television and looked at me, frozen, ghastly ring face from the beginning of the movie.
Ben?
Yes?
You did get your reference wrong. Because you're talking about the ring.
Yeah.
So you're talking about Samara.
Oh, yeah. Sadako is the paper cranes.
Sadako is Ringu.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, just a little bit of a ring nerd. Yeah, it's a good face. They're both good faces.
They're both good, terrible faces.
Yeah, I'd fit in very well with them.
After that, Scooter comes on stage to perform At the Hop, which was originally performed by Danny and the Juniors.
Interesting. It's got a lot of junior frogs on stage with them.
Yes. And once the chorus starts, this classic 1957 four-piece vocal is one lead singer and three backups. And the three backups are performed by a horde of bouncing frogs that pop in behind Scooter.
At the hop, 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 hop. When the record starts to spin, a calypso when you're chicken. At the hop, 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 hop.
Very quickly, they're more interested in hopping than they are in singing.
Yeah, as soon as Scooter says, let's go to the hop, they're all for it.
And they're just hopping, so much so that they basically stop singing and performing. And Scooter yells out, guys, we have to finish the song first. But nope, they run amok and the sketch is over.
Scooter's the perfect character to do this because he is out of the 50s.
Mm.
But I have a complaint, which is, since when does the gopher get to be on the show? We've seen Scooter do backstage numbers, which are emotional-based. But when does the highest-paid member of this show think he has the wherewithal to do a number in front of the audience?
That was a plotline before.
Yeah, I know.
With Muppy and Scooter doing Simon Smith and his dancing dog. So he was able to blackmail Kermit into doing it once. Now he's just doing it.
Just stay in your lane, gopher.
No, he has aspirations and he has leverage. And now we don't even need to see him applying that leverage. He's just taken to the stage.
It's good, though. It's fun. I'm just being mean to Scooter to be mean to Scooter.
Fair enough.
I'm sorry, Scooter.
I'm sure he can cry into his millions. Backstage, Piggy shuts the door in what I think is the prop room instead of just general backstage.
Yeah, I think so.
And where she's complaining that she's so hungry because it's been 20 whole minutes and she hasn't had anything to eat. Again, this is both a good and a bad joke in that it's ridiculous and so therefore funny that she would be this overdramatic over such a small period of time. But also terrible that she's feeling that much over so little.
I will say there is a very sweet moment in this sketch.
Yes, what's about to happen next is wonderful.
She looks in the mirror and she sees herself and she says, you're ravishing. Because she doesn't see that there's any problems here.
Right. And neither should anybody. So she's not ashamed of herself in any way. She has been dieting for 20 minutes. She sees, therefore, that there's been no change, but is perfectly happy with what she sees.
Yeah.
Again, much like the next bit, this should have been the focus of the sketch.
Mm-hmm. So she wants to see how much weight she's lost in that 20 minutes. She steps on the scale.
Which again, I just want to point out, is ludicrous that she thinks that it A, would have had an effect, and B, that there's going to be a noticeable difference that would be measured. That's just a level of delusion that is comic and successful.
Yeah, but I've done that. I've gone on a run. I weighed myself in the morning, and then gone on a run, came back, was all sweaty, took a shower, and was like, I wonder what that did. And then weighed myself and nothing happened. But I've done it multiple times throughout my life. I will never learn that lesson. I'll be like, I just did good. That must have done something.
There must immediately be an effect.
Yeah. I was going to say we've all done that, but apparently we all haven't done that.
Piggy has a classic tall dial right in front of you at eye level scale back in the prop room. Just ready for this, and she says, all right, scale, give me the good news. She steps on it, and it sproings with a great sound effect and breaks, and she is immediately angry.
And then she hi-yahs it for a hit, and the scale explodes.
Very powerful karate chop. Shuts doors and explodes scales.
I did have a problem with the fact that the scale breaking is simply a single spring coming out. It seems like, again, it does make the sproing noise, but one spring, one little tiny spring, if it's trying to get across that this is too much for it, it should be more than that.
The dial on the scale that's supposed to show what the weight is also spins.
Yes, it does.
And unfortunately, it doesn't register very well visually, but that's supposed to be what causes the spring to break and the scale to misfunction, is that it just, she steps on it, and instead of it going up to a number, it just spins wildly. But unfortunately, the prop scale that they've constructed for this joke isn't as successful as perhaps they'd hoped it would be.
Yeah, and also I'm being harsh on it because I want to be harsh to this episode, but this is one of the better moments of the episode.
After that, we have the first of a surprising musical number, in that it just starts with Teresa on a swing in a giant blousy dress and a big fascinator hat being pushed by Sweetums.
Hell yeah.
And it seems like it's going to be the open of a song.
What goes up must come down.
Which is the opening lyrics to Spinning Wheel by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the second single from their self-titled second album in 1968. But the song never gets started, because after those first lyrics, she gets pushed up and doesn't come back down.
Yep.
Sweetums looks confused, and then after an unrealistically long pause, she then does come back down and hits him from behind as he's walking away and knocks him over a stone wall.
And he commits to the hit.
Yep.
He flies into the hedges that are behind there. Like, it's hard.
This is effectively, it looked like it was going to be a legitimate guest musical number.
Yep.
And then it turns into a Wayne and Wanda bit.
Yeah.
And so, accordingly, Statler and Waldorf comment on it, saying,
it's the old girl swing monster bit again. They tried to sneak it past us.
Shoddy! Shoddy!
But then, in a brilliant piece of construction, they start the sketch over again. And they then do this three times, where they come up with different ways in which they can create some sort of weirdness with the swing based on the opening lyrics to Spinning Wheel. The second time is that Sweetums pushes the swing so hard that Teresa falls out of it, and there's the traditional loud clashing, clanging noise. And then she comes back on, her hat askew and her face pissed off, and she punches Sweetums squarely in the gut.
And then gives him an uppercut, which sends him yet again flying into the bushes.
And Waldorf, and I agree with him, says, it's getting better.
Statler says, I think you're getting senile.
Which I disagree with.
Well, I mean, the two things may not be directly related.
They may not be mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
And then we finally get to the actual spinning wheel part of the lyrics during number three, where Sweetums pushes her so hard that the swing effectively turns into a spinning wheel, and she does a 360 and comes around behind him and kicks him in the back.
This also does have some interesting camera angles for the first time in the episode, maybe. Because while the rest of them had a static shot, wide shot, you then get the angle of Teresa swinging up towards the camera, singing directly into it, which was nice.
I thought this was wildly successful.
Yeah, this is her best musical number.
But the basic idea of taking a Wayne and Wanda bit and turning it into a trilogy of jokes, they're combining At the Dance and Wayne and Wanda by basically doing a riff, but then by restarting it every time, going back to position one and just coming up with a theme and variation on it, and sort of continuing with the song. I really wondered the third time, are they now actually going to do the song? Was this all just a lead up? No, it was just an excuse to kind of make fun of the song and to turn it into a series of abuse. Yeah. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, this was great.
And Teresa did a great job of singing, of doing the bit at the beginning, of like committing to I'm performing, and then being effectively convincingly aggressive towards Sweetums at the end of each conclusive act. Being pissed, being vengeful, being gleeful at the fact that she got to smack him. Like, very good in her commitment.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. On all points. After that, we go backstage again to another Piggy segment. This time she is about to do a workout alongside a TV workout show.
And this is where we get the most overt satire of the idea that these workout programs may be saying that they're trying to help you out, but they're probably making you feel bad about yourself. The opening narration from the exercise program is, "Well, fatties, welcome to Chub Club. We're the only show where we lose viewers by the ton. Ha ha ha."
Yeah.
To me, this is an attempt at reclamation. This is the sort of stuff that, if this had been the only place that this was being done in the episode,
I'd be fine with it.
It would be straight satire on the beauty industrial complex.
Yep. But it's also the difference between this and the Scooter Kermit thing from earlier is this television host is saying it to the people. They're being upfront about it, saying it directly to the quote-unquote fatties.
As opposed to talking behind their back.
Yeah. This is a stranger saying it to people who have issues, which still not great, but at least you're putting it on Front Street and being honest about what a monster you are.
We then have three different exercises. The first is toe touches. The second is leg lifts, where it's revealed in another great piece of satire that as Piggy lays down on the floor, so that we then have Muppet legs, thing about which you are conflicted.
No, I mean, I'm generally pretty positive about them.
Well, you've generally been pretty positive about Piggy legs because she's usually using them to kick somebody. Here she's just doing leg lifts, but it's revealed that while she's wearing an athletic cut-off sweatshirt and has her hair pulled back in a messy ponytail, she is wearing high heels and fishnet stockings to work out in. I thought that it was pretty hilarious that the puppet designers and creators of this were like, all right, so yes, Piggy is working out, but Piggy is still Piggy.
Yeah, she's working out in style.
Piggy will actually have, in 1980, I believe, a workout album produced. Mm-hmm. There is a vinyl LP of Piggy workout songs. And in that, she's got leg warmers and she's got all the kit that has evolved into the sort of stuff that you need to do in order to see and be seen while you're working out. Here, the fact that she's sort of doing it, but also sort of not, is a great joke.
Mm-hmm. This is the segment that I was saying earlier, that if this was in a different episode, I would love this wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
But as the part of the whole, I like it, but I can't completely get behind it.
Because it's being done for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
The sketch ends with the TV host saying, "Can't you feel that fat falling away?" At which point Piggy falls down in exhaustion. So her fat is falling away, but with the rest of her.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.
We then have our major number, the song that I mentioned in the quiz, mm-hmm. Teresa singing Music, Music, Music.
Also sometimes known as Put Another Nickel in the Nickelodeon, written in 1949, as I mentioned, and then a hit for Young Brewer in 1950. And then she continued to be associated with it for most of her career. The basic premise is that there is a miniature jukebox with Teresa in a green spangly outfit in front of it, like she's a automaton in a Swiss cuckoo clock or something like that. And when Animal puts a couple of nickels in this Nickelodeon, the music starts and she and a bunch of Whatnot Muppets that are contained within the windows of the jukebox all start dancing along with this. The opening shot is, Pete, on your scale of best or worst green screens you've ever seen, how's it do with the giant Animal and Floyd in the foreground?
Fine. Because it's just a solid color background, you can tell it's a green screen, but it's not awful. I think it's because the way Animal and Floyd interact with the jukebox, I think it's both. Like, I think that's practical. They made one that was that size, and they framed it around it, because they hit it, and it reacts. So it's not there, but I don't know how they did it.
I think they just practiced as to where it would be, and then they shook the camera.
Yeah, but when they hit it at the end...
Yeah, so the end skipping. Of the sketch is that there's a repeated verse at the very end of the song, and they interpret it as if the record that is the jukebox that is Teresa Miniature performing it is stuck, and so Animal smacks the jukebox in order to get the record to stop skipping.
And when he hits it, everyone shakes to the side, and it seems like the jukebox moves. Like, yeah, it's probably a camera trick, but it's basically well done enough that I literally thought that
there was a miniature thing moving. That it was projected onto.
Yeah.
But we get back to the same problem that we had in the first musical number, which is that you've got a set that is fairly flat, that has compartments for Muppets to be in, that they're doing very limited action in. They're dancing together, but they don't really have much that's exciting to do, much in the way that Fozzie and the Mayhem didn't have much to do on the boat. And Teresa's dancing in the front, but she's doing a very small, simple box step. And the camera is either straight down the middle, or it's off to one side.
In one of the windows.
Or it's close up on one of the dancing Muppets. But there isn't anything particularly able to be invested in terms of the action. It's a straight performance, which isn't in and of itself a problem, but I don't find a lot to connect to or invest in here. And the song is, in its interpretation by the Jack Parnell Orchestra, sort of in between the honky-tonk origins and the disco interpretation.
Yeah, it's still solidly 50s inspired. I like Teresa's voice a lot, but as a performer, she's not very entertaining. The thing that this has that Cotton Fields didn't is at least these Muppets are moving interestingly, where the band was just performing, which I already find boring. But these Muppets, yeah, they're doing basic dances, but each window is doing a different dance, and it cuts between them, so it's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I can watch how these ones dance versus those ones dance. But yeah, it's nothing special. It's not a closing number.
It's screaming out, in my opinion, in terms of punch-up, for them not to be Whatnots. If they had been Muppets that we knew had personalities and each of the windows was doing, if they're actually doing different dances, which I can't comment on because I didn't notice, if you'd actually had them doing wildly different dances, if you'd had Sweetums and Camilla in one, if you had strange bedfellows or strange matchings and they were doing a full John Travolta dance in one quarter or an absolute ragtime dance in the next, and so they're doing something that is a comment on all the different music that could come out of a Nickelodeon, I would therefore look forward to cutting to the different windows because there would be action there that I would be interested in how it was going on. Instead, it's just a way of moving the camera from the action to provide some variety, but it's not adding anything to the song.
Well, Ben, The Muppet Show is a variety show, mm-hmm. so it achieved its mission statement in providing you with some variety.
Sort of saying that's not the case.
Yeah, I know, no, no.
They provided
me
with a variety of shots, but not a variety of content.
But would you rather the camera just stay on Teresa doing her mini box step? No.
It would be a more genuine interpretation of the song.
So, yeah, unfortunately, not a great closing number for the show. Because the next thing we see is the curtain. So, that's it.
That's all that we have this week. Have a great hand for Teresa Brewer, Kermit says. She comes out and she says, in turn, and let's also have a great big hand for the frog.
And then the big blue hand from the cold open returns and hits Kermit for hit number 7. Oh, wait, Ben, we gotta go back.
Because?
We gotta go back to the island.
But we didn't start the very first episode with a shot on a close-up of an eye.
Maybe we did. This isn't a visual podcast. Ben, we gotta go back to the island. And Animal hits the jukebox.
Oh, okay.
Is that a hit? In the past, we've said hitting inanimate objects isn't.
But it's an animate object.
And that's true. And this has the intention of, I need to hit this to do something.
And everybody that is in the jukebox is clearly jostled, and I've made way too many Star Trek references this episode, like they're on the deck of the Enterprise. They all rush to the side.
So I didn't think about it. I didn't put it in my notes as like, is that a hit? But when we talk about it just now, I was like, oh yeah, that might be a hit.
I think the way we're talking about it, it has to be.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
And yes, Kermit agrees with you, Pete, because when he gets squashed by the giant blue hand, he comes up and he says, I deserved that.
That's true. Piggy then enters and tells everyone to exercise because when the pig exercises, everybody exercises. And she gets everyone to a run in place while she counts.
And weirdly enough, there's a Gonzo stalker moment in this where he comes on from the left side of the screen, but as they're running in place and maneuvering around, he then ends up on the right side of the screen and is sort of leering too close to her, and she yells, get out of here, squeak.
Creep.
Check the transcript.
In this case would be the first time the Disney Plus captions are wrong, because in the Disney Plus captions it says, get out of here, creep.
Creep I would like better. I listened to it twice. I heard squeak. We'll see what the fandom transcript says.
We'll see you all next time on The Muppet Show!
The transcript also says squeak.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with creep.
I think it is a very weird shortening of pipsqueak, but she leaves off the pip.
That makes sense.
It doesn't, because nobody ever says that.
Right. Yes. But the short...
And also, he's not that much smaller than her.
Well, according to Kermit and Scooter, he is.
Oh, dear. And at the end of the episode, Statler and Waldorf are back again, and Waldorf says, well, they did it again.
Whatever it was, says Statler.
Which would have been the perfect Statler and Waldorf closing to, like, a couple episodes ago, in the closing number, Kermit comes on and says, well, that was another half hour of whatever this was. Like,
yeah.
It should have been in response to that kind of an introduction. This was a fairly tight episode. Tight in not necessarily good ways, but thematically tight. I'm not sure that this is the right Statler and Waldorf closer for this episode.
Mm-hmm. It's not great.
Well, I'll be intrigued to see how that reflects in your rating, but since we don't judge the episode, we're only evaluating the guest in terms of rankings, we'll find that out after you first provide us with your statistics.
There were 8 hits, 1 explosion, and no human Muppet kisses. For music, this was a medium episode.
A venti episode?
Yes. There was 46.46% music for 12 minutes and 19 seconds out of 26 minutes and 31 seconds of episode. It's under half. It's above average so far for the season. Average right now is 44.54%. Lots of music, but not as much as I would have expected from someone who is basically only known as a musician. After learning that, I was shocked to see how much of her stuff wasn't music. And also considering I'm now moving seamlessly into rankings, even though I just transitioned and called it out.
It was seamless until I made this big seam.
Yep. That for someone who's known basically exclusively for singing, that's the worst parts of this episode. She does such a good job when she's being herself backstage. That cold open, when she gets hit with the big hand, she laughs and has this huge smile on her face. She clearly loves the fact that she's on this show. Mm. And when she's backstage, you mentioned it in the animal segment, after she pops up with the grease paint on her forehead, she has the biggest smile on her face. She's so happy to be here. And it's so contagious that you're like, oh, this person is having fun doing the show. And then the things that she's known for, she's boring.
Which, again, I come back to the idea of where do I want to put the blame for that? They clearly found good things for her to do in terms of being a guest star, except in the musical numbers. Except, I mean, I'm tempted to wonder if they had done Spinning Wheel as an actual full song, mm-hmm. or a 2-minute song excerpt from it, would it have just been 3 locked camera angles on her on a swing? Would they have been that uninspired? Is there something about either their relationship with her as a performer where she was like, no, when I'm doing music, I'm doing music, and therefore I want that to be produced solemnly? Or was it that when she came to the table and she said, well, these are the songs that I think we should do, they were so disconnected from the material that they couldn't find anything interesting to interpret about it?
Now, Ben, this is going to be a surprise to you.
I'm prepared as much as I can be for something I can't be prepared for.
I wasn't alive in the 50s.
You're blowing my tiny little mind here.
I know. But I think we've been spoiled by The Muppet Show in that Teresa Brewer is a singer. She is a musician. We've gotten used to Broadway stars.
Mm.
There's a difference between a Broadway star and a true musician. I have a feeling that Teresa Brewer sings during her live performances and is not interested in performing.
The early 19-year-old performance of Music, 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 where she's part of the Dixieland All-Stars, also begins with her putting a nickel into a jukebox and then walking over to a microphone, at which point she then just stands in front of a microphone and sings.
Yeah, Teresa Brewer has been a performer for 30 years at this point.
Yeah.
She started with
different expectations as to what you should be doing on stage.
Elvis is one of the people point to he shouldn't be shaking his hips while he's singing.
Right.
She inspired Elvis.
Right. So she was literally the model that people who were upset by Elvis were like, you should be performing the way she does on television, standing rock solid and doing nothing.
Yes. So I feel like that's the reason why. So, all of that to say, 18. I hated her musical performances. Not her performances, because her voice is undeniably good. That yodeling is incredible.
Yeah.
Her ability to match that yodeling is incredible. But it's boring and it's yodeling, so I don't like it. But, again, to sing her praises,
yeah.
All the backstage segments, she's great. The smiles that she has, she's having such a good time. So because of that...
So why not closer to the middle? Roughly 50% of the things that she did in this were great.
Yeah.
And 50% of them were stone cold boring. Why not closer to the middle?
Because the boring parts were boring. Yeah, so the good parts dragged her up. Not by much, but higher than Edgar Bergen. Because my complaint with him was... he didn't connect with the Muppets at all. And she connects with the Muppets. So I had to put her higher than him. My initial instinct was to put her lower than him. Mm. But when I was looking at the list, I was like, no, she did a better job with the Muppets. She's got to go higher. So he's 20, she's 18, leaving a little gap for maybe movement either way.
As always, we end each episode talking about our 5 favorite moments of the episode. Moment is not a full sketch, but it's a piece of production, of screenwriting, of line delivery that we wanted to particularly highlight. And I'm going to start today by talking about, while we're still on the topic of Teresa Brewer, the opening of the Spinning Wheel sketch, I thought that Statler and Waldorf claiming that we are all familiar with the well-tired trope of the girl slash song slash monster bit was so imaginative. And that Statler yes hands him on that. Earlier we talked about the fact that Strange Fork and Hogthrob were really good at refusing to acknowledge that they were in the middle of a bit. Statler and Waldorf took them to the hoop on that by doing the exact same thing of being committed to the idea that we are all just bored out of our minds of girl swing monster sketches. Ugh, you can't hardly turn on a variety show without seeing one more combination of girls, monsters, and swings. Blah, 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 blah. So funny.
Yeah. I will say the swing is the X factor, because usually when a woman is the guest star, there is a girl monster bit.
Right.
But that swing differentiates it. For my first moment, our second moment, I want to talk about Animal. The way Animal runs in shouting autograph is splendid. Autograph! It's a precursor for the greatest Muppet segment of all time. In Muppets Take Manhattan, when he just shouts woman over and over again, chasing a woman through the offices of Broadway.
Yeah, see, I'm more in favor of Muppets in Space, where they realize that that's problematic behavior and they shouldn't be encouraging it. I'm much more a fan of Animal shouting bad man in Muppets Take Manhattan and attacking Dabney Coleman for kidnapping and holding a chicken hostage.
Yeah. But
because Coleman has to be the guest Muppeteer of Animal when he's
being attacked,
going
yeah.
through the hallway and Animal's locked onto his foot and being dragged after him. Oh, Coleman does such a good job in that segment. And Animal and he, by extension, are hilarious.
Yeah, I agree. That's very good. It's not as get ready to take a shot iconic. As Animal shouting woman, but
you're not wrong. That is what everybody else remembers as being iconic. Take a shot.
But we're not talking about either of those segments in this episode. We're talking about him shouting autograph over and over again. This is the precursor to that iconic take a shot moment.
Well, since we're talking about that sketch, and since I talked earlier about when the puppeteers are able to convey emotion just by the angle of a head that doesn't actually change, I want to talk about how good Crazy Harry is in that bit. Because when he, first of all, the basic premise of Crazy Harry's autographed a page by blowing it up is so funny. And I love that she's like, yeah, I have a page with a hole burnt through it. That's clearly Crazy Harry's autograph. How can you not recognize it? But when he shows up, having heard his name like Nosferatu, she doesn't say, no, I think we're good to a second autograph in a way where she's like scared or worried about it. She very much downplays and throws that line away.
Hey, wait a second. Whose autograph is that?
Crazy Harry.
Want another one?
But he is disappointed and saddened by the opportunity to not blow something up and sort of puts his head down in a depressed way and moseys off camera in maybe the best performance in the whole episode. I love that quiet moment of desperation so much.
Yeah, this might be the only time Crazy Harry appears outside of the orchestra pit and doesn't explode something. Because the only explosion in this episode is not Crazy Harry related.
It's true. While you're creating headcanons for this episode, Pete, maybe because he didn't have the ability to blow up her autograph book, he just went and planted explosives in the prop room.
That Piggy then set off accidentally.
When she high-odd something.
Yeah. She didn't hit it so hard that it exploded. She hit it so hard that Crazy Harry's explosions exploded.
Because he was frustrated at not being able to have exploded something earlier.
I like it. For my fourth moment... Nope. For my second moment, our fourth moment...
Very good.
For an episode that I talked so much
negative, because I didn't like a lot of the Teresa Brewer segments, the music segments, and I don't like the theme of The Runner.
Mm-hmm. Appropriate in both cases.
I bolded a lot of things in this episode, because there are a lot of little moments. So, I'm going to go back to the opening, when Gonzo apologizes for shooting flames out of the trumpet. The way he looks at it and says, sorry, sorry. The two sorries kill me, and the way he's meekly apologizing for it. It's perfect. Great job, Dave.
To take us out, I think we have to come back to the best part of the episode and go back to Cheesecake.
Mm.
I genuinely was surprised when the Cheesecake started talking. I don't know why I was, because it's basically the same Muppet as the cake from the Swedish Chef episode.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that, because the way it's cut unevenly. It's a diagonal slice through that Muppet.
I guess I didn't think that somebody could fit in the upright piano and puppeteer it. And so when it started talking, I was genuinely surprised and laughed out loud. And that second voice singing along in the song is part of the original composition of the song.
Hmm. Cheesecake, munching on a cheesecake, munching on a cheesecake.
Cheesecake.
But in rewatching this episode, I was trying to figure out what it is precisely about the cheesecake that makes me laugh. And the answer is all of it.
Yeah.
It
also barely looks like a cheesecake. The way that cheesecake edge appears is more frosting than traditional cheesecake crust.
You're not a boy from the South. I think Jim Henson grew up in a land where you put frosting on the rim of a cheesecake.
And that's how you end up like Piggy, apparently.
Too bulgy to be in a ballet. Yeah, I'm struggling to bring this segment to a close, because while I starred and circled this, if I meant to write why, I utterly failed to do so.
Yeah, you're going against the premise of the moment by saying, the whole thing's great.
No, not the whole thing. The whole performance of the cheesecake.
Got it. Right.
The voice, the construction, the placement, the fact that it can fly. The cheesecake as an entity, when I went back to rewatch it, I remembered the surprise of it talking and was just gleefully waiting for it to happen again. And when it did, I was there for it.
Mm-hmm. Gobble, gobble. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Leona Amling. Thank you, Leona. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformed to fair use, much as the Henson did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review, but there are things, dates, facts, names, descriptions of electrical resistance, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Shoddy!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 1, guest starring Don Knotts. Yay!